Hi, I'm James McManus, and you're listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days. 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it. You're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to the Breffni Early Show. This week, my guest in the hot seat definitely fits the description we like to have for our guests. Interesting, inspirational, and motivational. We're going to talk about adventures for the next hour or so, and specifically how one man managed to turn his love of adventure into a full-time business and still get to go adventuring as part of all of that. James McManus, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
James, we're going to talk all about Earth's Edge, your business, over the next half hour or 40 minutes or so. But first of all, I want to talk about you and talk about where your love for adventure came from. Tell us a bit about you growing up and where adventure fit into your world.
Okay, sure. So I grew up in Roscrane, County Tipperary, and from a very young age I just loved being out in the outdoors. From about 5 or 6, my parents had me out hiking different places around the country. There's a great story of me and a few cousins getting dragged across the Schlieblooms, you know. You know, in the Irish hills you have like heather maybe 2 feet off the ground and boggy ground. So we were so small, we were kind of stepping over that as a normal sized human would maybe step over a fence. So it was like really, really tough going. That's my first memory of being out in the hills.
Sounds like torture.
Yeah, it was torture, yeah. And there's a famous family story there. My dad was supposed to have the lunch with him in the car. And you know, this is back in the times where it was like picnic basket, flask, you know, roastery chickens, that kind of stuff. And he forgot it, you know, and there was an absolute
Irish father.
Yeah, it was a revolt, man. People were, people are still like giving him grief over it like 30 years later, you know. So yeah, that was those kind of things. So yeah, got out all over the place. My parents are big into hiking. My dad does trips with me now, and my mum unfortunately has passed away, but she was big into hiking as well. And then when I was like 9, I started kayaking. So like a lot of people, I started did an introduction to kayaking course in Killaloe. And then I joined a canoe club in Limerick, joined Limerick Canoe Club. And then that was really my big passion through my teens. Did a lot of whitewater kayaking and got into kayak freestyle as well. So that was really what I spent a lot of my time doing. When I wasn't in school in the evenings and that, I used to go paddling with mates. And then I went on to represent Ireland in the kayak freestyle world championships in 99 in Sort in Spain.
Tell us a bit about freestyle kayaking. I have seen it once or twice at the InterVarsities, which probably isn't the best reflection of the high end of the sport, given the nature of that specific event.
Yeah.
But tell us a bit about freestyle kayaking and how that works.
Yeah, so basically freestyle kayaking is like, you know, snowboard or BMX freestyle. In theory, it's quite similar. So what you're given, let's say, a minute or 90 seconds to go into a hole or a wave and do as many tricks as you can. And then
when you say a hole, I'm going to pull you up just because the technical terms, because I think I get what you mean, but the listeners mightn't. So hole is, let me see if I can get it right first.
Yeah, cool.
A hole is at the bottom of, say, a weir where the water just churns around and gives you different options in terms of just then flat water.
Exactly, yeah. So a hole is at the bottom of a feature, and basically the water is rotating on itself. So when you put your kayak in that position, it's held in that place in the river, but then you can engage the nose or the stern into the fast flowing water, and you can do loops or cartwheels or spins or all different types of tricks. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm trying to paint the picture for the listener. I have a fair idea of what you're talking about myself personally. So you were pretty handy at this then, if you're out.
Yeah, it was at the time, you know. That was an amazing experience.
Should I ask how you got on?
Yeah, I got on all right. Like, I did, I was in the juniors, so I think I came 17th in the world at the time.
Respectable.
Yeah, it was
better than respectable.
Yeah, no, it was pretty good. and it was great to get away, you know, like I was 17 at the time, so I had a good time, and the APRA competition was particularly fun, you know. That's the great thing about all the sports.
It's the thing you're not supposed to talk about, is it?
As a professional athlete or whatever, yeah, but it was always good fun, you know, so I enjoyed that aspect of it. And now I did, I gave up freestyle many years ago, like kind of a year or two after that. The main reason was that you'd go to a country to compete in an event, and you'd have, let's say, a warm-up session in the feature for an hour per team. So you'd have like 20 people in the Irish team, and you'd get an hour between all of you on the feature. So you actually might only get like 5 or 6 minutes yourself per day for the 5 or 6 days leading up to it. And then you have like a minute in the competition or whatever. And it was just a lot of money, a long way to go to get that. So I moved away from that and got more into expedition and whitewater kayaking, which is a really amazing thing to do. It's the best way to see a country, in my opinion.
I've seen some movies at the Why Not Adventure Film Festival last year.
Yeah.
One that stuck out for me was called, I think it was called Varun.
Yeah.
Leon McCarron, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Leon, he's from the north of Ireland.
Yeah.
Decided he was going to trek the length of the longest river in Iran.
Cool.
So he started off with a pack and hiking down the snow, which I hadn't associated with Iran before, but started hiking with the snow, eventually took the blow-up kayak out of the back of his backpack and his paddle and set off down the river before finding bikes and swapping his back or his kayak for bikes and cycling the remainder of it. But they absolutely had an absolute blast. It looks amazing. Where have you taken kayaks across? I'm presuming at this point, given the nature of what you do now, that you've been abroad and you've been in some pretty wild and wondrous places. Where's the most awesome place you've been in?
Yeah, it's a question I get asked a lot, and it's a difficult one to answer. I think for me, my favorite place to go in the world kayaking or trekking is a place called Ladakh. I don't know if you got to see it on your round the world trip. It's in northern India. It's just on the edge of right up in that kind of northern part of India that it has very close to the Pakistani and Chinese border.
So we're talking in the Himalayas.
Yeah, just the very northern part of the Himalayas, quite close to the Karakoram, and it's a high altitude desert, and it's a Buddhist area. The Dalai Lama has his summer residence there. Lots of massive mountains. So, in 2004, when I was 21, I think, I did a 300-kilometer kayak expedition on the Sarip and Zanskar rivers, and you pass through this canyon called the Grand Canyon of Asia. It's a really epic trip. And that was like one of the best kayaking trips I ever did. It was just such a cool adventure. Like, the river is so inaccessible. To get to it, you have to drive for like 4 or 5 days. And the road up, you're crossing a number of high passes. Like, some of them are 5,500 meters, the actual motorboat roads. And the thing that makes it difficult is you're getting up from Delhi in August, which is the middle of the monsoon. So we came to a road, and it's like, you know, your classic alpine
switchback,
and a monsoon flood had come and knocked out 20 switchbacks. So we had to hike with our kayaks using porters to get to the other side of the pass, then pick up more vehicles and go again. And when you get onto the Sarip, the start of the river, it's flowing out of a glacier, and it's only like, it's pretty small, man. It's like maybe a tenth the size of the Liffey, let's say, in Dublin. And when you finish where the Zanskar hits the Indus, it's 20 times that size. And it's just an epic journey. It's all at high altitude. You don't meet any people for the most part. And it's really, really good, tough white water as well. So it's a mental and a physical challenge. And the best experience, like one of the best experiences I've had is when we, on that expedition where we came up across the Puktel Monastery, which is a remote Buddhist monastery in the Himalayas, and it's basically cocooned on the side of the river valley. So we got to spend the night there, and it was an amazing experience. We had, let's say, on one particular day before we got to it, we had 5 or 6 hours of really intense white water. We were all quite tired, and we saw a nice beach that we were going to set up camp on, and we just pulled the kayaks in there. And then high on the side up on the right, we saw the monastery. And the next thing is we saw these guys, like young men, running down the hill towards us with a big cloud of dust and smoke coming after them. They were running down so fast. And it was all the young monks from the monastery coming down to see us. So not that many people kayak this river.
Yeah, it sounds pretty remote, so I'm guessing they don't get to see too many people.
No. Like, to hike into this monastery, it takes 15 days, okay, from the nearest town. So, and the river is hard, so not that many teams take it on. So they might see one kayaking team a year, if lucky. So if you can imagine it, you're in the middle of nowhere, no smartphone, no PS3, nothing for them to, you know, to occupy themselves with. Suddenly, six guys pull up in kayaks. You're like, oh my God, I'm going to go check that out. So they were really excited to see us. They came flying down the hill.
In case you'd be gone before they got there.
Yeah, exactly. But it was really great. You know, they were initially shy, but after a few minutes, they got really comfortable with us. So they were like trying on our helmets, putting on our buoyancy aids, you know, using the paddles, trying to actually get into the river in the kayaks, which is be a big no-no because it's really full on the river. And this was going on for about an hour. And we were like, you know, this is amazing. We're conversing with really young Buddhist monks, you know.
And then you kind of go, okay, hang on. This was cool for 5 minutes. Now it's like, we want to set up our base. We want to set up our tent.
Yeah,
can you please leave us alone?
That's exactly it. And the interesting thing is they actually found our emergency whistles. And they've never used whistles before. So, you know, imagine you're like PE teacher blowing his whistle at you. But they were like, they got six of them and they were blowing them full blast and it was the most hysterical thing. And this went on for like half an hour. We were like, oh my God. But luckily, we heard this big bell go off in the monastery way above us. You know, it was a really steep canyon. And suddenly the boys just started filing back up to go back up to prayer. And two kind of middle-aged monks came down and invited us to go and stay in the monastery, which was absolutely amazing. Like, we had planned to camp in, like, we were carrying all of our own equipment in the tents, so it was really basic. We were having, like, you know, boiled rice and some nuts for dinner. So they invited us to go and stay in the monastery. They had a little room with blankets in it we could stay in, and they made us Tibetan momos and Tibetan stew, and it was amazing. And I actually, randomly, this is a good one for you, I had my first cup of tea in that monastery.
What?
Yeah, so I didn't drink tea at the time. But the interesting thing is, in this area, right, so you can kayak the river in the summer, but in winter it freezes over, okay? It gets to like minus 30, minus 40 here, so it's like one of the most inhospitable places in the world in winter. And as a way of getting weight on during the summer, they put yak butter into the tea, okay? So they actually, imagine it, like put a spoon of Dairy Gold into your tea and drink it. But like, this stuff was disgusting. But anyway, you know when you're in like some...
Do you drink tea now?
Yeah, I drink gallons of tea now. But that was my first time.
Do you put yak butter in it?
No, not really. Not at all. But the thing is, you know when you're in someone's house and they offer you food, you'd know from your travels, like if you get into someone's house...
You feel bad saying no, even if it looks horrible.
Yeah, you're gonna have to eat it. So it's like gulping back the tea, saying thanks. And it's one of these cultures, if you finish your drink, they offer you more. So it's kind of... But that was an amazing experience, you know, and to be waved off by them. And really interesting, again, you'll know from your travels, you know, people think other countries are so different to Ireland. And what I find in my experience is people are really similar. In Ladakhi or Tibetan culture, the first son in a family, he stays and works on the farm. The next guy goes to become a Buddhist monk. And then the next guy goes to get educated. So, you know, it's kind of like Ireland in old times as well. So the monks were ranging from like the age of 6 right up to 80.
Six?
Yeah, they go to the monastery at that age. You know, I'm sure it's changing a little bit now, but even then in the like early, that was 2004, that was still happening. You know, they go there at 6, yeah.
I'm just thinking in my head bad things about the Catholic Church in this country with 6-year-old kids in their care would just... It's open to abuse, and that's all that would worry me. But let's not focus on the negative. Yeah. This isn't about negativity. It's not supposed to be about negativity. Yeah. So kayaking obviously was the release for you in your early 20s.
Yeah.
At what point did you realize that, A, maybe that kind of lifestyle isn't sustainable into the future, just been on a never-ending trek?
Yeah.
Where did the business come out of?
Yeah, so I started the business in 2007. So before that, that trip in India was 2004. I'd already done big expeditions in South America, Africa, and in 2005 and 2006, I was basically living the life. I had the best lifestyle I think I've heard of everyone. What I was doing was working on a building site in Ireland for 2 months of the year, for usually February and March into April. Then I would fly to California, do a summer rafting season there, which was amazing. It's an amazing place. The States, I mean, California is just epic for adventure sport. Then I would either do a month or two in New Zealand, or I went just doing different personal trips, and then I went on to do winter seasons working in the Indian Himalayas guiding. So that would kind of take me through right up until the end of January into February. End of January, we tended to go to southern India to chill out in Goa or Kerala, do some yoga.
Just back from Kerala.
Yeah.
I was in Kerala in February. I want to go back. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, it's awesome. So
I'm back 4 or 5 weeks and I'm missing it already.
Yeah, so the end of a kind of an 8 month season guiding, we'd go down there and sit in the beach and do yoga and just enjoy the heat, and then back again to Ireland, do 2 months, get some funds together and go again. So it was amazing. But
it seems like you worked the whole way around. It wasn't just fun.
Yeah. Well, I was raft guiding. So, you know, like in India, I was working for about €150 a month.
Okay.
And in the States, I would have been on about $100 a day. So it was a really good lifestyle, but it was definitely kind of hand to mouth. You know, I wasn't putting away money, or I wasn't in a position where I could come back to Ireland and, you know, be able to afford to live in Dublin or anything like that. So around 2007, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do long term. And, you know, adventure industry is, anyone who'll tell you who's working in the sector, being in Ireland or overseas, it's extremely difficult to do it and have a sustainable lifestyle. So I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Becoming a teacher was on the cards, and this, that, and the other. And then eventually, while out on a trek, I decided I was going to start off the business and start bringing people on adventure holidays in India. That was how I started off. And it was crazy at the start, man. It was so funny.
What was your first trek? First expedition?
First trip we did, I took one of my wife's friends, Sinead. She still reminds me of this. She's was my first client ever. I took her on a 25-day trip in India. She did
just you and her?
Me and her, and then I had a couple from the States. There was three of us, yeah. Oh, there was me, the three of them, and then I had a couple of local guys work with me as well.
And your wife was okay with you bringing one of her friends? She wasn't your wife at the time, was she?
No, she's my girlfriend at the time, yeah. Rosie, yeah.
And she had no problem with you bringing your friend away to 25 days in India.
Yeah,
very trusting.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Rosie actually worked with me in India and the US. She's a raft guide and she works as a vet now, but she knows the scene, so it's all good.
Okay.
Yeah. But that was my first trip. Interesting thing, you know, like, I'm sure we're going to get on and talk about the business now, but at the start, right, I had done so many personal trips, but I knew nothing about the travel trade. Like, it'd be like you doing lots of, you've done a ton of cycling, then suddenly deciding to open like a cycle shop. You'd know effectively nothing about retail.
I wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah, but yeah. You know, you kind of think maybe he'd know that because he does a lot of cycling. When I started off, this is just to tell you the mentality. So I'd never booked with a tour company before. So when I went to, let's say when I was 18, I went and worked in Zambia for 3 months on the Zambezi as a safety kayaker and raft guide. So I just booked a flight ticket. I didn't have anything arranged. There was no
visas, no nothing.
I had no tourist visa. I had no work permit. I just basically rocked up in Livingston and went around to companies, asked them, could I go on the river with them for free? And then after a couple of days, I found someone, and then they saw that I was good in the kayak and they offered me work as a safety kayaker. So I had no concept of people who, let's say, didn't have the confidence to go and do that, or actually wanted a better service than that, than kind of having to, you know, negotiate with a taxi driver straight off the airport and all these things. So when I started Earth's Edge, we were working in India, I told my clients, we didn't do flights at the time. So rather than meet them at the airport in Delhi, what I was doing was saying to them, I'll meet you in New Delhi railway station, okay? That way, listen to this, this is crazy, you can book whatever hotel you want, and then you can actually book your own transfers to the railway station, which is going to be easier for you. That sound, you're looking at me like you've got three heads, because it's as crazy as it sounds.
Half of me is saying, that's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah.
And the other half of me is kind of going, oh my God, how did they even book the holiday in the first place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think people booked with us because they could really sense that I had passion and such knowledge of these places. And that's still something that we carry through today. Like, it's, I'm really, really matters a lot to me that people have an amazing time. But really, like, Delhi is one of the most, if not the intensest cities in the world. And like, New Delhi Railway Station is like the center of that. It's just like the most hectic place in the world. You know, you got so much going on there. You got like 20 different platforms that are all like full with people.
Yeah, but I'm just back from India, as I said, and I spent 2 months there on my cycle, and I know how busy India is, particularly urban India. There's just people everywhere.
Yeah.
So if you get separated from somebody anywhere, it can be a nightmare to find them again.
Yeah.
Trying to find them in the middle of probably the hotspot of activity in terms of communications and infrastructure in Delhi, in one of the biggest and most dense cities in the world in terms of population.
Yeah.
That's got to be a nightmare. How did you even find the people you're looking for?
How do we find them? You know what? I don't even remember. No, we just had a meeting point on certain platforms, and we got them. You know, we managed. We didn't have a problem. But it's changed now. Like now.
Yeah. Obviously, tell us how it's changed.
So that was 2007. So at that time, I was predominantly online, selling packages to individuals or couples and small groups, and it was actually really good because I stayed small, and I made all these small mistakes, learned from them, and then moved on. So in 2010, 2011, we were ready to start scaling the business. 2010, my mom passed away of cancer, which was like a big, from like, if we're talking about the company here, it had a big effect on the business, just because I was just kind of a bit of a mess for about a year, unbeknownst to myself, you know. I wouldn't be the best at talking about my feelings and all that, so like, people ask me, how are you getting on? Oh, I'm grand. Yeah, I'm grand. But reality was, I wasn't, you know, so I really couldn't focus on work. Then in 2011, we really kicked off. We operated our first charity challenge. We started working with the Irish charities, and they basically came to us at ready-made groups, and we managed to scale the business. Because what's really hard in my business is trying to get people onto trips. That's the challenge. I had running excellent expeditions down, like I could run treks. We now run treks like better than any company in the world. It's just getting people on them and getting the word out there that took time. So from 2011, we operated our first charity challenge for Concern. And in 2012, we basically smashed the Irish market out of the water and ran 15. And then the business has grown steadily from there. So it's kind of changed from me with my laptop, and kind of spending 5 months of the year in India, to now I have three people working with me in the office in Dublin here in Donnybrook, and they're absolutely awesome. They basically run the business and kind of give me a kick in the arse when I'm trying to do some crazy new expedition that we're never going to be able to sell. I still lead 4 or 5 expeditions a year. So this year I'm in Peru, China, and Tanzania for a total of about 60 days. And then...
It's a real tough life.
It is a tough life, man. It is tough.
Jealously or anything.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. And then we have a team of guides, about 10 guides. And we work... my guiding team are absolutely amazing. They're the best people available to me, Irish guides, who are absolutely awesome at their job. They're all working full-time in the outdoor industry here in Ireland. And then they go away and lead trips for me as well. And then we send a doctor on all of our expeditions as well. So our doctors, they come away with us, they do one trip a year, and they're all GPs or A&E doctors who have a passion with expedition and high-altitude medicine. So that's where we're at the minute.
I think you've already answered my next question with your last two lines. But what makes you the best tour operator in the world for adventures? Because that's a pretty big statement.
Yeah, like, what makes us the best? Well, it's really all of my staff in the office, they all go and do an expedition a year. So when you inquire with us, if we get someone who knows nothing about trekking, or, you know, maybe has done something like Crowpatrick or Karen Toole once, we have the expertise to talk them through getting them up to doing something like Kilimanjaro, which is a 6,000 meter peak. It's got like, you know, less than, it's got like 40% of the oxygen that you find at sea level. So it's a big ask for people. So we can walk people through that. We have that skill set. We also send an international guide, in our case an Irish guide, and a doctor on all of our trips. And that's those things are key in what makes us the best, really.
So when you get out there, there's no issues with translations or languages. You're dealing with someone from your native tongue, basically.
Yeah, you are, and which is awesome, but you're also dealing with local guides. I mean, you don't want to pay us whatever our trips cost, like between 1,500 and like $5,500, travel halfway around the world, and then listen to an Irish guide all the time. That kind of defeats the purpose of traveling. So we work with we have an Irish guide who's managing the whole expedition, and then we also bring in experienced local guides who are working with us as well. Because ultimately they add a lot of local knowledge on the actual mountain, and also the local culture, flora, fauna, they really add a lot. And we work with some amazing people around the world. It's absolutely awesome.
I want to hear more about some of the adventures, some of the stuff you got up to, because hearing about the monastery and hearing about other things you've done, if I was to ask you to list 4 or 5 of your favorite things, or whatever number comes into your head, of what are the memories when you look back at the expeditions you've done that really spring out at you? Because I know I have some. I have specific days or specific people or specific places that when say, oh, what was your favorite thing? Just this kind of almost a slideshow goes through my head of people and places that I met. Who features on your slideshow?
I guess a really cool trip I did, it was in 2012 in Malawi. We did a cycle trip, and my dad, he's 70, his name is George, but he's a GP as well, so we try and do a cycle trip, we try and do an expedition together where he's the doctor and I'm the guide at least once a year. And like, to be honest with you, like, I love all the trips and they're all really special, but it's more the interaction with the people on there and just having good banter. So anyway, in this trip in Malawi, we were staying overnight in this tea plantation. So you just imagine like kilometers and kilometers of groves of tea. You've seen it in India.
In Kerala, yeah.
Yeah. We were staying, we were camping in there, and we'd had a really tough day. I had not so experienced cyclists. They'd done 10 to 12 hours the day before on the bike, so a lot of sore asses, basically, you know. And the next day we were starting off really early. We had to get out of this tea estate and get onto the main road. So from where we were camping, it was about 2 kilometers to the main road. And there was a lot of different small kind of borings or roads you could take out of this place. And we went out in convoy. We were all cycling together. And we got to the gate. I did a head count before we started moving. And I was like, oh my God, there's somebody missing. I was like, oh, who is it? Like, so I was on the radio, like, speaking to my support guides. Have you seen anybody? I was counting up the heads. I had, like, 15 people in the group. And then suddenly I relaxed because it was like, whew, it's only my dad that's missing and not one of the customers, you know?
Yeah, that's a relief. It's only dad. He's fine.
Yeah, he's grand. So basically he'd taken a wrong turn, hit the road ahead of us, and then just started cycling and got it into his head that he was behind us. And started cycling faster and faster and faster. So he got way out ahead of us. And you know, he was asking local people directions or had they seen us. And he was getting mixed.
He was getting a proper adventure.
Yeah, he was. So eventually we sent a vehicle ahead and we found him. And we managed to catch up with him. But that was really good banter. We got lots of the good slagging there. My most recent trip to Kilimanjaro was really, really special. We have changed a couple of things up there for this year, so I was just going to check that out last December, and I met some amazing people there. One of the things that's really important to us as a company is sustainability, and we've become the first Irish company who are affiliated and part of the Kilimanjaro's Porter Assistant Program. And basically what that means, it's called KPAP. They're an independent NGO in Tanzania, American run, but based in Tanzania. And they audit companies who go on the mountain to make sure porters are treated properly. So they send one of their staff on our climbs, and they basically monitor a couple of different things, that we have all our porters are clothed properly, they're fed properly, they get paid a fair wage, and they get a fair percentage of the tips. And just sorting that out is particularly important to me, because unfortunately, if you don't go with the right company, porters get really badly exploited on Kilimanjaro. It's very, very sad, actually. You know, stories there of people not getting fed for a couple of days at a time, and they're doing such hard work, man. They're like carrying like 15 kilos on their heads, and in some cases up to 45 or 50 kilos, and walking uphill for people who are struggling to get up there, just carrying their own weight. So that's an amazing place. Like, Kili is just, it's such an epic mountain. You know, it's the highest freestanding mountain in the world. So, you know, obviously you got Everest and hundreds of peaks higher than it, but as an individual mountain, it's coming straight off the Rift Valley. So it's literally flat, and then you hit Kili and it just goes up, 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 up. It's amazing. And going on that mountain, meeting the local staff and just sharing it with other people from Ireland, it's an amazing experience.
It's been on my bucket list for some time, and that's kind of why we met each other, was because I got in touch and trying to sort out my trip to Kilimanjaro, which I'm very excited, looking forward to in February of next year, all things going well and all things being equal. And hopefully we'll have a few of the listeners maybe coming with us as well, but we'll be sharing more details of that in the next few weeks. Is that your main attraction? Is that the big name for you, Kilimanjaro?
For us as a company, yeah, it would be. It is our most popular trip, just because it's really amazing. We also do the Machu Picchu trek, which is really cool. I'm actually going there next month. Really looking forward to that. And then another big one would be Everest Base Camp, which is one of the most iconic treks in the world.
I'm loving, by the way, the listeners can't see this, but we're sitting in your offices and there's a wall which is pretty much entirely taken up by a map of the world. And as you're naming places, I'm just flying around. It took me a few minutes to find Malawi, I have to be honest. I did find it, though, just beside Mozambique. But it's fabulous just looking at it, and you're just throwing out names of places like Peru or China or Malawi or wherever. And I love the idea of just being able to kind of go, yeah, I'm going to go here this week, here next month, there next year. Where have you not been to that's still on the bucket list?
Yeah, for me, Patagonia would definitely be up there. I haven't been. Also, Alaska, I really want to see those places for sure. To be honest, my bucket list, I'm ticking it off. Like, the number one thing on my bucket list is a mountain called Musta'ata in the Tian Shan range in China. So, all your listeners will have heard of Musta'ata.
Yeah,
before.
No, obviously, of course. Yeah.
Now, it's up, it's above India and Pakistan, near the border with Kyrgyzstan. It's a 7,500-meter peak. So, my wife and I and two of our friends were going to climb that in July. So we'll spend a month there, 5 days driving to the mountain, 5 days getting back, and 20 days on the peak. And if that goes well, we'll probably take on an 8,000 meter peak next year. That's the plan. So those are my immediate bucket lists. And after that, we'll see where it takes us.
8,000 meter peak. We're kind of getting close to Everest at that point.
Yeah.
Is that a goal?
Yeah, so there's 14 mountains in the world that are over 8,000 meters, Everest being the highest one. It is a goal, yeah, for sure. I would like to do it. When I'll do it is another story, but yeah, definitely, why not? Everything is a goal, but it is there. I'd like to try an 8,000 meter peak unassisted by oxygen as well, and try Everest as well in that way. I don't know if I can do it, being honest with you, but it's never been done by an Irish person before, so I'd like to do that.
Unassisted with oxygen.
Yeah, so everyone, most people who climb 8,000 meter peaks use oxygen, and especially above 8,000 meters, and it has been done without oxygen, but not by someone from Ireland. So I'd like to do that first.
I like your ambition, and very best of luck to you.
Yeah.
I do have a question, because I probably watched it maybe 2 years ago now, when it first came out, was The Summit.
Yeah.
Which is obviously the ill-fated trek on K2, where Ger McDonnell lost his life, the Limerick man. Obviously, you've been from Musgrave. I don't know if you knew Ger.
I didn't know Ger, no.
But you would have been very aware of who he was.
Yeah.
How much is that a factor in your thinking when you plan these things? Because whatever about doing Tanzania and doing Kilimanjaro, because people go and they do it, they either make the top or they don't, but there's very little risk of any major danger on Kilimanjaro, despite, I know Ian McKeever was killed tragically on the mountain by a strike of lightning.
Yeah.
But you can't really legislate for that. Yeah. But K2, 25% of people who start that don't ever make it back down the mountain.
Yeah.
Does that come into your thoughts when you think about 8,000 meters?
It doesn't. When I think about 8,000 meter peaks, I don't think about that. But
should you think about that?
I think everyone is different, and some people will think about that. I think what you need to do, in my opinion, is to go out there and take on something like that with a very, very good attitude, that you can control the controllables, which is basically yourself, how your physical and mental condition going out there, and then you give no control over the uncontrollables, which are primarily the weather. And when you take on these peaks, if you're lucky enough, the mountain will say yes and give you a window to go up. But if it says no and says it's gonna basically on you, or the weather's gonna be really bad, you have to take that answer, and you have to walk back down, because even something the height of Kilimanjaro can produce some serious weather. Obviously, an 8,000 meter peak, Kilimanjaro being less than 6,000, is a different story. If the weather is bad, you need to get off it extremely quickly. And I think, without knowing Dur and without being there, I really can't comment on his situation, because I know nothing about it really, apart from reading about it, so I would not like to form any kind of opinion on it. I think for me, it's making that smart decision and turning around, because these mountains aren't going anywhere. You have to turn around and, you know, try the next year or whatever. What makes it hard for people is K2 and Everest, and even this mountain. It's a month of my time and quite a lot of money. So something like Everest will cost a climber upwards of 50,000 euros. So when you've invested 2 months and several years of training and that kind of amount of money, it can cloud your decision-making process. If you're within a couple of hundred meters from the top, and the right decision is to turn around, those kind of factors can make that decision hard for you. And that's something that I believe that I'm good at. I've been very good at to date, and I want to keep doing that, you know, making those smart decisions.
What's the hardest decision you've had to make on a mountain?
Like, touching wood, I have, apart from one peak in 2004 in the Himalaya, 6,000 meter peak, I've summited everything I've tried since then. But we have had expeditions where we're turning people around. I haven't been guiding on them, and it's just something that you have to be very strict on. You know, what we say is, we say safety first, friends second, and summit third. Like, you just have to, it's a difficult one. You know, where people are, you know, going to climb Kilimanjaro with you in February, and the presumption is there that you're going to get to the top. And for a lot of people, and you know, we take 97% of people who climb Kili with us, they go to the top, but it's still never a guarantee. Like, you still have to, you have to go out there with the mentality, if I'm feeling good, I'll go to the top, but if not, you know, you just gotta let it go. You gotta walk back down, because there's just such a risk there. You know, last summer we were in Kyrgyzstan climbing a 7,000 meter peak called Peak Lenin. It's one of five mountains over 7,000 meters in the former USSR. And on our descent, a Russian mountain guide was killed in a crevasse, you know, really close to us. So I don't think about those things, but I am aware of them, if that makes sense. There's a real danger there.
Yeah, it's about mindset. You got to just assume that everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
But obviously, for those who have lost people in these situations, it's obviously something.
It's difficult, because you have to put everything into getting to the top, but where the vast majority of accidents happen is on the descent. So when you go to the top of a mountain, you have to know, I still have quite a lot of the tank to get myself back down, especially on a larger peak. Like, you have to push yourself very close to exhaustion to get to the top, and you still need to know you can come down. And on any mountain over 7,000 meters, like if anyone has any trouble on Kilimanjaro, we have a huge team of porters and guides that we can literally carry someone off the mountain if needs be. It's never happened. But over 7,000 meters, if you decide that you can't continue, there's nobody there that can help you come off the mountain. You know, that's why on a lot of 8,000 meter peaks that there are people still up there that have, you know, died many years ago. And there's not to put a downer on it, but there a lot of these peaks are littered with bodies, you know, people who've passed away. In some cases, you know, they were unlucky. In some cases, they made poor decisions. And, you know, you'd have to go and ask one of those, each and every one of those bodies, what exactly happened to them, because people will form opinions on that. And unless you were there at the time, and in that person's mind, you don't know what happened. You know, that's the reality of the situation. It's every situation.
It got very morbid there.
It did. Sorry about that.
No problem at all. I think I directed it that way by accident.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
What are your highlights? What are the standout moments? We kind of mentioned one or two of them earlier, but
yeah,
when you look back at the last 10, 15 years of gallivanting around the planet,
yeah,
what are two or three of the best stories that you have to tell?
Best stories, okay. Right, so let's talk about gallivanting, okay? Let's talk about carrying on. I went to work on the White Nile, source of the Nile in Uganda, when I was 19. So I was...
Is your wife going to be okay with you telling this story?
Yeah, she's going to be totally okay. Cool. Okay. She knows all about it. I was working in Jinja outside Kampala, and we basically went on the river, one of the largest whitewater rivers in the world, every day working. And then in the evenings, we just partied really, really hard. And then one particular day, we decided we were going to go to Kampala, which is 2 hours away, party through the night, and come back and get straight on the river again the next day. So we turned up for the river, and instead of going in our kayaks, we were asked to enter this rafting race with a team team from a company, like a corporate group. And the race was in aid of saving the white rhino in Uganda, okay? Because they're really under pressure from poachers. So it was a fundraising race, and this one company were short a few people, so we jumped on, still steaming from the night before, did the race, won the race, and then we won this prize to go to Queen Elizabeth National Park to basically stay in a very, very luxurious safari lodge there. So the following day, we got on a bus, and it's basically, if you've ever traveled on a bus in Africa, if any of your listeners have had that experience, a public bus, you got a 52-seater bus with about 100 people on it, chickens in the bus, bags, like, you know, you don't just have your own seat, you got to share it with a couple of other people, and you might have like a box of chickens at your feet and stuff like that. We spent 10 hours in that. We got to this, to the end of the road, then we drove in a Jeep on the back of a pickup truck with about another 20 people to get to this wildlife lodge in this escarpment in the Rwenzori Mountains near the border with Rwanda. Absolutely epic place. And when we got there, the whole lodge was being run by local people who were a pygmy tribe. So they were very small people. And it was just the most amazing experience ever. We stayed in this, like, we'd gone from living in, you know, small tents that people would use in a festival for the last 6 weeks to going to this luxurious safari lodge. And it was an amazing experience. We got to walk through the jungle and track chimpanzees on foot. And we also got to go out in on the savannah and go on wildlife safari, which is just, it was just amazing. And then we went back again. So that was kind of like just a really epic couple of days, where we were just out on the beer in Kampala, and we ended up going to Queen Elizabeth National Park and having just such an awesome time.
I do love how the most chance encounters and pure circumstantial stuff just happens. I have so many chance encounters. I met a guy, I don't want to talk about myself too much, but on my cycle, which you've mentioned once or twice, I met a guy in Goa and bumped into him randomly in Chennai.
Wow.
I also met a couple in a roadhouse in the middle of the Nullarbor Desert. And maybe 2 weeks later, bumped into them at a petrol station just outside Adelaide.
Mm.
Now, those distances, the people who are listening, are about 1,000 to 1,500 kilometres apart.
Yeah.
On different sides of the same country, mind you. But it would be like meeting somebody in Belfast and then walking into them on the street in Cork actually further than Cork, in Madrid,
yeah,
or Valencia a couple of weeks later. So it's completely random, but that happened two or three times where you'd meet people and then randomly they would meet me again in certain places. So they would remember having met me because obviously I was a bit more distinctive than they might have been to me. It was crazy just getting tapped on a shoulder in a petrol station in outside Adelaide going, did we meet you in the Nullarbor?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's completely crazy.
Absolutely, yeah. It's look, I mean, that's what travel is all about. It's like an education in itself and just seeing these places. And that's what we're really passionate about, taking people off the beaten track and just going to see some amazing places. And the other thing is, like, in our trips is the great thing about it, and you'll know this again from your own experiences, is just the fact that when you're in a wilderness environment and your phone isn't working and you're just off the grid, life becomes so simple. You know, when you're like going to climb Kilimanjaro, once you get into the park, you're literally getting up in the morning, hiking, having a bit of lunch, hiking again, and then resting. There's none of the everyday logistics of life, of getting to work, you know, like picking up kids after work or whatever it is. That's the beauty of these trips, you know. They're just the headspace that you get, that you can actually, you know, be off the grid and then reflect on what you're normally doing in Ireland and just look at what aspects of your life that you can cut out that are negative and just really, you know, you'll notice they're gone quite easily on a wilderness trip, and just looking at those and going, you know what, that's BS, I'm not doing that anymore, if you can. I think that
you can't very well just cut it like dropping the kids to school.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you kind of still got to do that. But I do take your point. It's
there
are so many things and so many people I find who just suck everything positive out of life.
Yeah.
Call it what it is. They just don't fit into a positive lifestyle. And sometimes the biggest thing I did in my life was probably removing two or three individuals from my life, and it turned my life completely on its head in terms of how I looked at my day, just getting up in the bed in the morning and not having to look at a boss or talk to a person or whoever it might have been that was just a negative influence. And you're right, on the bike, I found that was just, you got your headspace every morning. I got up, had a bite to eat, got on the bike, lunch, got on the bike, dinner, got on the bike, found a place to stay.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what you're saying in Kilimanjaro. I'm so looking forward to getting back into that kind of mindset again. It's going to be really, really cool.
Yeah, for sure.
Just wish it wasn't 10 months away.
I know. Look, I think, like, I can totally relate to those. You're talking about those two or three people. Like, I think when I started off, when I told people what the company I wanted to do is to take Irish people on adventure holidays, I mean, there was a lot of people lining up there to tell me I couldn't do it. And, you know, to a certain extent, there's still people who are doubting. And as we get bigger, people will put pressure and just be negative. And, you know, sometimes it's not always possible to cut them completely out of your life. It's you just gotta
manage. If it's a brother or a sister, yeah, can't really just go, yeah, could you get out of my life, please?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I take your point.
Yeah.
If most people are dispendable, yeah, if they're of that persuasion,
yeah,
I find.
Sure.
I
yeah.
find.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still kind of fixated on this map to our left hand side. It's absolutely amazing just looking at it. Because I look at it an awful lot differently now than I would have a few years ago.
Yeah.
It was just a picture a few years ago, art. Now it's actually, each name on the map is either a memory or a potential future memory, which is kind of cool. Is there anywhere on the map that you haven't got to yet that you want? How many countries have you been to?
I've been to, I think I'm just less than 50 now.
Okay, I'm not too far off.
Yeah,
okay.
I was going to say, I would have thought you had been in more with your cycle trip, especially your...
The cycle was 27.
Right, okay.
And it was just a straight line through Europe, so I missed a lot of countries.
I think Alaska is a big one. I would like to go and climb Denali at some point. It's the highest mountain in North America.
Formerly McKinley, of course.
Yeah, McKinley, yeah. And Patagonia in southern... Chile and Argentina would be one I would love to see. The thing is, man, like, you know, the list, it only gets longer. This is the thing, you know. People will be kind of thinking, I'm going to do Kilimanjaro, that's going to be my thing. But unfortunately, or fortunately for me, people want to do more and more. And, you know, I know you're from Leitrim, I'm from Tipperary, you know. It's interesting when the more you travel, you realize these places aren't the center of the universe. and there's life going on outside them. Yeah,
Leitrim's not the centre of the universe.
It's actually not.
No, it definitely is. It definitely it is.
Yeah, but there's so much to see. Like, I mean, Central Asia, this area I'm going now this summer, and I was there last year. It's really epic. It's so vast. There's a lot going on there. From a point of view of mountains, it's really impressive. And a lot of unclimbed, or as we like to call them, virgin peaks that have never, no one has ever walked on there as well. Which is something I'm really keen to do as well. I'm trying to think where else I would like to go. There's a big list there. There's quite a lot of Nepal that I haven't seen. I'd like to see more of that. And places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, I'm just really hopeful they're going to open up again, because the people there and the countries are just stunning. Like, so some of the most friendly people, and beautiful, beautiful mountains. I would love to go there. So
you made a joke about obviously Tipperary and Leitrim not being the centre of the earth, but what does it feel like now when you get home to Roscrea, or do you get home to Roscrea?
I don't get down there a huge amount. I go, and my dad lives in Roscrea. I still go down there maybe kind of 5, 6, 7 times a year. I always like going down there, you know.
Does it make you appreciate how lucky you were to grow up in rural Ireland? Because I know when I go home, I do love Leitrim. Like, I love spending time down there. I didn't do it for long enough in my 30s. Sorry, 20s. I'm aging myself. I didn't do it for long enough in my 20s and probably my early 30s. Now I'm based down there, and I absolutely love the people, because the people I grew up with, they're still there for the most part. You know what I mean? The same characters, the same people in the same places every day. It's such a simple routine, and I love knowing what's out there. I love coming back to that. I don't think I'll probably be there for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But it's that nice kind of familiarity. Do you enjoy that when you go back, or do you even get to experience that?
Yeah, no, I did. I do enjoy it, definitely. I think, like, growing up in the countryside in Ireland is amazing, you know. And I definitely love going back there, and I'm still really good friends with a lot of people I went to school with, and it's always good to catch up with them, you know. But I think growing up in rural Ireland is amazing. Like, we do expeditions for schools, and there's a statistic there now that teenagers that came out of the UK have less than 5 minutes of unsupervised time per day. Outdoor time, excuse me. So less than 5 minutes of unsupervised outdoor time. So without knowing you in your childhood, I know for a fact when you come in from school in Leitrim, you threw your bag in the corner, you ran outside playing with your mates, okay?
Yeah.
You had no phone.
You go down to the schoolyard on any night of the summer, and you'd have 25 or 30 people, which in a small place like Leitrim Village, where I'm from, is every kid in this town was involved. Whether you were 10 or 18, you all hung out and played together. Like, there was one football match every night, or a game of rounders, or a game of something happening. It was all outdoor, and it was virtually all unsupervised.
Yeah, and listen, it's not a formal classroom setting, but there's a huge amount of learning going on there. You know, you're learning to deal with different people. You're learning teamwork, leadership skills. And nowadays, kids don't do that as much. Everybody has a phone, so, you know, if you don't know the answer, you can look it up on Google or call your parents. People, especially in more so in urban settings, are being driven from school to supervise sports, to supervise study. So those learning experiences people are missing out on now. And I think growing up in rural Ireland, you know, I spent summers on my uncle's farm, like throwing sheep around and all this kind of stuff, and going out messing with my cousins, and, you know, the usual antics that goes on in rural Ireland, like, you know, whatever it may be, it's another whole story, but those experiences really shape you as a person, and I think they're important. I think it's a great place to grow up, and I just hope that those values and raising kids and doing that in Ireland, they people get the opportunity to still do that as they did in my time and your time. I think we're of a similar vintage, you know.
In terms of the future, what does the future hold for James McManus and for Earth's Edge?
Well, the business is growing. Let's talk about the business. The business is growing kind of 20 to 30% year on year. And there's a huge amount of opportunities for us to scale it further and do more trips. We want to try and run more expeditions in different places. The likes of Kilimanjaro and Machu Picchu and Everest Base Camp, they're like our gateway, I was going to say drugs there, but trips. So once we get people hooked,
well,
on
they
them,
kind of are, yeah. It's like we feed them a little bit, and they get them hooked, and get them doing the more risque stuff.
That's it. Not even more risque, just more remote things that aren't necessarily on people's hit list. But some amazing places that we're running trips to. We do several other lesser known peaks in the Himalaya. We've got like a trip to Mount Kenya, our Kenya Tri-Adventure expedition. So we want to do more expeditions that are off the grid. And then for me personally, at the moment, I want to climb larger peaks, more remote peaks, and possibly more technical peaks as well. And other than that, really, I'm like very lucky to be doing what I'm passionate about, enjoy my life, get to spend a lot of time with friends and family, and hanging out with my dog, Jonjo.
We haven't mentioned Jonjo at all, because I had the pleasure of meeting Jonjo. Jonjo's the face of the company.
Yeah, he is becoming the face of the company, definitely. He's been producing informational videos on, he's brought one out on altitude sickness, and he's going to be bringing more out on packing, types of boots to wear, and things like that. So he's my dog, but he lives a life. He's more like a child than an actual dog. My wife and I, we're dog people. Yeah, Jonjo's a cool customer. If people are going to check us out on YouTube or what have you, they'll see his videos. And he is becoming a bit of he's the face of the company. I can see an aggressive takeover bid coming on the cards in a few years, you know.
Management buyout. Yeah, exactly. Jonjo's going to lead the rest of the staff.
For sure.
We always finish the show with the same question.
Yeah.
The listeners to the show, if you had one ask from them, what would that be?
That's a cool question. To be honest, I would ask them to just get out there and do whatever they want to do, you know. If they want to do adventure trips, definitely get in touch. But what I would like them to do is just to genuinely just go and do whatever they're passionate about it, and not wait around and just absolutely go for it. I don't know, that's the first thing that came into my head. You know, spending 12 days climbing a 6,000 meter peak isn't for everyone, but whatever they're passionate about or whatever is on their bucket list in life, to go and do it. Because it's been an amazing experience for me to figure out what I want to do and go after it. And I wish people the very best in doing the same thing.